Hey, welcome to the Ed Show, number 96, I do believe.
Getting up there.
We're closing in on number 100, my friend.
Got something planned for that?
Maybe we should talk that as a team or something, right?
Next team meeting. To-do list.
We'll add it into the OneNote file that we're using to collaborate and sort of stuff. My name's Rick Claus, joined by Mr.
Simon Perriman.
It's been a while since we've been doing the
it
news
has,
together, my
friend.
Oh, it's a light news day that's going on.
But big news stuff. Not many items, but kind of some big stuff here.
Definitely some big news movers and shakers, if you will, that are going on in the news today. The first one is, in case you've been sleeping under a rock for the last, year or so.
Long hibernation.
You know, Windows XP is about to go off and disappear. It will no longer be under support. It's EOL, end of life. It will not be extended unless you decide to partner with Microsoft for a very expensive extended support contract. That's the official word. Come time when it turns out to be April 8th, 2014, there will no longer be any updates except for antivirus updates available for the free antivirus software release for Windows XP. Came across a good blog post, actually, targeting people that are from a security blog, targeting people about using XP still in small businesses and individual consumers that might still need
to use it. You mean after that April 8th?
After April 8th, which is just crazy that they still
would. So why? What are the bad things that can happen?
Well, literally anything.
Okay.
Literally anything. But in the blog post, Tim Raines from the security side of things has gone through and basically worked out some mitigation factors you could use. Obviously, the preferred thing to do is to always go in and look at moving to a more modern operating system like Windows 7 or Windows 8. Because as soon as you do that, you bring in 10 plus years of additional cybersecurity and safety and bug fix, that sort of stuff, into the modern operating system.
And let's be realistic, 10 years in the PC era is multiple generations.
As I always say whenever I talk about migration from XP, if you had a dog when XP came out, it would be dead by now. I mean, really, come on. But if you do happen to have some friends and some people that work in the small business area that still have to have access to Windows XP, I'm just going to look here at the blog post. I got some great stuff. Risk number one, if you do happen to still need to use Windows XP, surfing the internet, guidance, don't do it.
Don't do it.
Number two, opening email and using instant messaging, don't do it. Phishing attacks, very, very easy to do. Number three, using removable drives, don't do it. Number four, worms for any newly discovered vulnerabilities or release vulnerabilities. So you have some kind of networking connectivity for your machines, really don't do it. And then also, obviously, CryptoLocker and ransomware also was out there as well. So generally, what could you use the system for?
I guess almost like a word processor where you're printing locally.
Yeah.
We call that a typewriter,
that
right?
That could work. Or maybe it's a completely disconnected system that does some kind of control of an oven or some circuit board manufacturing company or something like that. That's really about it. Now, Windows XP Embedded does have some extra life to it, and that's another whole story. But honestly, looking at more modern stuff, the good thing about this article, I'll have the link inside the news items, it does have some upgrade advice for where you can go for resources. We just finished a big MVA with Michael Niehaus and a bunch of other deployment gurus all around some resources for what you can do, as well as even visiting a website, amirunningxp.com, that will basically check and look at your version of the browser, look at your version of the OS, and then make recommendations on some upgrade stuff. Please look at those resources, migrate off if you absolutely can. If you can't, there's some advice in there. Don't be fooled by what some industry people are saying. Oh, don't worry, we'll support XP for a long time, because they're not Microsoft. They are individuals that are simply selling antivirus software, and antivirus to run on top of XP is not a support channel that you're going to want to work with. I think we're going to have to be covering like XP migration stuff all the way past April 8th. We should do something fun for April 8th, I think. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. Sounds good. Well, the times are certainly changing, not just with XP, but also in China, because we are happy to announce that this week, Windows Azure will be coming to China. That's right. And in the past, you know, China is kind of being locked down, right? They have the Great Firewall of China. It's tough to get information in and out. And for that reason, our local or Chinese customers, they haven't been able to take advantage of Azure and Azure-based services. They just cannot use Azure within the country. So we realize China's obviously a huge market now, right? You know, billions of customers, a half billion people on the internet. So we really wanted to make Azure services extendable. So we've actually partnered with a local service provider based in China, put Azure in their data center. So we are going to be able to offer Azure services through our Chinese partner to all of our customers in China. Very shortly. Very good.
Now, I know there's a couple of blog posts that we linked to inside the news down at the bottom there. One by Takeshi himself talking about this, and also the official Azure blog for notices. So look there for the full details, but it's a pretty exciting offering to be able to make it available.
It is.
Now, you did some actual work in China not too long ago for some presentations, and is this something that people are asking about, being able to use Azure, how to work around this kind of issue of having, you know, local resources, the ones that are running and working with Azure, or running with services that are being that are providing services to the Chinese public?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I was in Beijing for TechEd China about a year ago, and that was just one of the hot topics. You know, we had all of these speakers coming from the States. Everyone's talking this three cloud story, put everything in Azure, but that didn't go so well with the Chinese audience because they didn't have Azure. They didn't have those capabilities. So if you are currently in a situation where there's not a local Azure data center in your country, or for legal, compliance, you know, PCI, whatever reasons, you can't actually use Azure services, always consider your local service providers. Remember, one of the big benefits of Azure is that ability to scale out your data center, extend it when you need additional, you know, storage, additional compute power. And again, even if you don't have Azure, you can still take advantage of extending your data center today by working with one of our existing service providers.
And I guess also some of the technologies we make available, like obviously System Center, Private Cloud, and now even the Windows Azure Pack.
That's right. Bring
on top
it
of that, right?
Premise now.
So you can bring it on premise and possibly up to partners in your local countries that are running the System Center stack and the Hyper-V stack with Azure Pack on top of it, as an example. So I've been good options because it's a great portal experience. More news to come on those coming up in the near future.
But there is an even bigger Azure announcement, right?
Yes, in case you didn't know, it was announced just on the 25th of March that we're changing the name Windows Azure over to Microsoft Azure. So just a sign of the times. Basically, we're just trying to, again, make our brand more agnostic across the board and also more representative of all the stuff that you can do on Azure. Because when you think Windows Azure, you think just the Microsoft platform. Mm-hmm. When in fact, that is not true. I mean, if you look at all the images that are available inside the Azure Gallery for new VMs, if you're doing infrastructure as a service, there's a ton of instances that are not even running on top of Windows. They're on top of Linux. They're on top of CentOS. They're on top of even competing platforms like Oracle database products, that sort of stuff, as well as on the platform as a service, being able to support PHP, being able to support Java, being able to support Python, Chef automation, all sort of stuff. It's truly a platform that has embraced a lot of these open technologies you can go off and use. And so name change goes in effect on the portal and other creative type stuff, I believe, according to the blog post over there, April 3rd. That's around the time of Build going on in the not too distant future. And we're just going to be simply calling it Microsoft Azure.
Get ready for that one.
Yeah. Coming up after the break, I've actually got a little conversation. It's a second interview I did with a good friend of mine, Ned Pyle, from the Ask DS blog or the DFS file server type blog as well. At the end of the last interview I did with him about DFSR, I just posted him a question just on the side saying, hey man, is there anything else you want to talk about? And he says, you know what, can we just do an interview around when to use scale-out file server versus when to use traditional file clustering for a file server. And I'm like, sure, let's go ahead, let's do it. Boom, this was the result. Nice, clean, and tidy, about 10, 12 minutes or so. But it really kind of clarifies the facts, the questions that he's getting on his blog all the time about the differences between those two things. So come back after the break, we'll wrap it up. But go off, take a look at this interview I did with Ned in the hallway. Hey, it's Rickster CDN from The Ed Show, and I've got Ned Pyle here joining me once again. I figured, hey, we just did this quick little thing about DFSR. And I'm like, you know what? You're on the file server team. I've got the question of questions that I get all the time. I'm sure you do as well. And I was wondering if you can explain to me, when would you use a scale-up file server versus a traditional clustered file server? One way or the other. Have you ever gotten that question before?
I get that question almost every day.
So how about we? I'll give you the platform to answer it once and for all.
Okay.
Nice and clear. Give us some clarity.
Gotcha.
On when would you use the fantastic SOFS for scale-up file server?
Right.
And when would you use a traditional file server?
So I can answer that. It's one answer in 78 easy parts.
Okay.
It's really just boils down to a couple of things. First thing is to understand what scale-out file server does and why it's good for what it does.
Okay.
So the important thing to understand about scale-out file server, and I will probably draw again here like I did previously, is that it is designed for application data workloads, which simply put means that a scale-out file server which is in a cluster almost exclusively, is designed to present itself as a single server with a single share for a bunch of other servers to connect to. And all these other servers are one of two things. They're hypervisors, mm-hmm. compute nodes, probably we hope Hyper-V, or SQL servers. We hope Microsoft SQL, but you know, whatever, you know, SQL's a thing. So the idea is that all these nodes can connect in, and they gain several advantages from the scale-out file server. One, the first one is obvious. If I only have one share to manage, and it runs on all these nodes simultaneously, and then with the magic of CSV, alphabet's hard, the data is presented to the nodes actively. The data sort of lives everywhere quasi-simultaneously. The share lives everywhere quasi-simultaneously. And the management becomes very easy. And the availability becomes extremely high. And most importantly, we make some guarantees. To do all this, we use a feature called continuous availability. And continuous availability is really the secret sauce of scale-out file server that says, I want to make sure that if this node croaks, that, see, here's the thing, is when you're using a hypervisor to run its disks on another server, so the VHDs are over here and the VMs running down here, it cannot have an interruption any more than if you're running your laptop and you pull the disk out for just 1 second, the laptop's not going to survive that. You know, I just nudged it, too bad. There's no nudging allowed in this environment. The same goes for SQL. If the database just magically disappears for 1 second, he's not going to be like, oh, that's fine. Let me just recover from that nicely. So the idea is that if you use SMB3, and this is where it gets super boring but also fancy, to connect your compute node into this crazy scale-out file server cluster, continuous availability will do two things to the share. One, the client and the server will keep track of this handle using something called a persistent handle. And if something fails, the server will be able to tell the client, hey, I preserved your handle over on this node. You should just connect back. Just pause your IOs for a second, which the app will understand. It just seems like things are getting slow, up to a minute or two even. And then just resume it over here, right where we left off. Boom, all set. And to make sure that things are super groovy is if that node died in the middle of me writing I/O, that could have caused the data to become damaged, obviously. Mm-hmm. So when you go through the CA share, we're enforcing this thing called write through, or FUA, there's a million storage acronyms, to guarantee basically that it's on the disk. Written through to the disk, no buffering, no caching, no goofy stuff happening in the top layers.
Because I guess if it wasn't written to the disk, it would still be in the memory of the compute node.
Yeah.
And therefore, it could say, oh, didn't get written correctly.
And it'd still be in the memory of that node when it died. And so the data somewhere or the other never would have been on the disk. Once you resumed, the handle would be to nothing. The data wouldn't be there. You'd have a corrupt file, cats and dogs living together, anarchy.
Yep.
So this is scale out. And it sounds fantastic because, well, never mind Hyper-V and SQL. Any file sounds like a benefit from this. Any sort of experience would benefit from this. Me, as an information worker, so the guy with a laptop sitting at his desk, pounding away on the quarterly report, of course I want this. This sounds fantastic.
Yep, and that's probably where a lot of the questions come from.
That's right? Where the question comes from, is why shouldn't I do this for everything? And there are really two reasons. If you boil it all down, there's really just two reasons. One, go to the red pen now. In order to do all this stuff with CA and write through, you're taking a performance hit. Now SQL and Hyper-V and all these big data applications and stuff actually operate in such a way that they really understand I/O Notepad doesn't understand I/O, but Hyper-V's and SQL do, and they understand how to maximize the benefits of this, to send data in larger chunks, to not do things like VDL extension, and all this kind of stuff that costs a lot when you're working in a synchronous write-through world. They minimize it. That's one thing. That's good. So as a user, the first thing that people do when they test this out, they set up a scale out, and their first test is to copy a big file to it. And they find that it's copying a big file, depending on hardware and many other factors and how they copy the file and the application they use, is suddenly about 1.5 times slower. And depending on hardware problems and other things that crop up, I mean, much slower. I found one app I used as a test, it's 10 times slower.
Oh, wow.
Crazy for it to create a file. The way it created a file was just super inefficient when it went through write-through. Like, it was, it was terrible. And you have no way to know without testing. Hyper-V will work, SQL will work, big application data will work. Other stuff, you know, the remaining million or so applications in the world, you have no idea. That's one thing. Now, if you're using, like, Office, Word, Excel, that kind of stuff, you probably won't see a performance hit because those things don't actually write to the disk very much. They're actually making temp files and working copies and auto-recovery files and only saving in the background and stuff. And they're designed for, you know, if your question is, well, I like the reliability aspect of it, they already have reliability. I mean, Office has been working in terrible, crappy networks for 20 years. Mm-hmm. They're used to it, and they built their own version of this basically decades ago. So they don't need you to set up and make this better for them. They're already fine.
Okay.
That's the first part. And it's livable. It's a little bit slower. I could live with that. Here's the real big problem, though. CSV, file system, that layer that we put on top of NTFS or RFS, whatever, when we query that file system as an application running on the server, it says, I'm not NTFS anymore. And that means, and here I have to go to my list real quick, just to, because the list is so darn long, unfortunately. That branch cache, DFS namespaces, DFSR, file classification infrastructure, FSRM, dynamic access control, folder classification infrastructure, all this stuff, their services will start up, look at the file system that you pointed to wherever their data is, and say, this is not NTFS, you're not allowed to use me.
Okay.
So you set this all up, it works great. You're using Office. You're not seeing a performance problem. This is fantastic. 6 months later, someone says, hey, we got audited, and we need to start using dynamic access control and file classification infrastructure to make sure we're not putting stuff out there for the NSA to stare at.
Okay.
I can't turn it on.
Because it's on a CSV.
Because it's on CSV
volume.
Which means I have to throw this all away and start over.
Okay.
And everybody's extremely unhappy. There's no way to predict the future of what you're going to need to use for these. But these IW features are designed for IW, which is, there's still cluster here for all of them. That's general use file server. I mean, scale-out's a mode you pick. Mm-hmm. Pick the default one, and it'll tell you in the UI, and you'll be fine.
Okay. Traditional file server cluster for your file servers, for your information worker style workloads.
Yeah.
To prevent the future changes of going into something, as you mentioned, like classification or whichever. For workloads, now you mentioned Hyper-V, you mentioned SQL, but then you also kind of casually mentioned other stuff as well. How do you know what that other stuff is?
You let that vendor tell you.
Vendor basically tells you this works with
that's the best way to go. That's the best way to go. Have that vendor tell you, because if they want to support it, they'll know all about it. And they're going to want you to, and they're going to be excited.
Probably want you to use it, obviously.
Yeah.
Makes their overall experience better.
Exactly.
And major changes for 2012 R2, the biggest thing that I saw was the ability to dynamically rebalance loads when you added in another node, basically, is the biggest candy that we get.
That was the big one. Okay. There were significant I/O improvements in certain workloads and stuff, about
SMB3,
you know, half again improvements there.
Yep.
But it was very much a point release, so SMB only revved 0.02. You know, don't expect anything massively new there. And obviously, things are happening right now that we can't talk about.
So, scale-out file server for your apps and applications, example, hypervisor like Hyper-V and SQL.
Right.
Everything else, traditional file server cluster for your information worker files.
Yes.
You heard it here. Ned Pyle laid down the law. No more questions. Fantastic.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks a lot, man.
Appreciate it.
Welcome back. Well, that was a pretty interesting interview I saw there. You know, back from my cluster days, I got asked the same question, right? It's always like, well, I have a Word doc. Can I put that on a scale-out file? No, again, really want to emphasize that point. You scale-out file server, what it's designed for. And it's really optimized for that. But general purpose file server, that has its own use as well.
Mm-hmm. Hope you guys like this. Why don't you let us know? Send us a comment. You can do it the old-fashioned way with good old-fashioned email at edge@microsoft.com. You can comment down below inside the comment area. Let us know how we did. If you have any subjects you'd like us to cover or something like that in the not-too-distant future, you can reach us at Twitter. We happen to follow @TNEdge. I'm @RicksterCDN. What's your Twitter handle, man?
I'm @SimonPerryman.
There we go. And then finally, last but not least, there's also the Edge Show app you can go and download from the Windows 8 store if you're interested. They've got some links in there to stay up to date on current episodes. We look forward to hearing from you as we march closer towards episode number 100. And we'll see you next week.